Well, I'm really glad to have the opportunity to be here with you. I appreciate the invitation and the chance to even just to get the chance to visit with you again. It's been, I think it's been about 5 years since I've been able to assemble with you. The last time that my family and I were here was at a Friday night, a gospel meeting of some sort. And I've always enjoyed getting to know you and visiting with you here, and a number of you I know from camps and some other activities, and maybe you've seen a lot of me and when I was, you know, not as old and mature as I am now, and you can just pretend that I am very old and mature right now, if you remember me from a few years ago. I really enjoy the chance to be with you, to worship with you, to sing with you, to commune around the Lord's table together with you. I got to think about my family and friends back in Albany and that I am there with them in spirit and in heart, but also here with you now in that activity. And that was a blessing to me to do that together with you. And I appreciate the opportunity, or the invitation rather, to come and speak with you and get to know you and this congregation better, and looking into possibly helping me in my work in Albany. I didn't think about it until the announcements, actually, that maybe you would want me to talk a little bit about the work in Albany. And I do have some opening slides, not on this lesson, and that's fine, because I feel like on a Sunday morning we're doing a lot when we come together, and I'm sure that all of you can sit longer than I can talk, but your children can't. So for tonight's lesson, I'll have some slides about the church and the people in Albany and the work I'm doing there. So I'll try to include that on a lesson tonight, if you are interested. So if that's something that you want to hear, make sure. Okay, I'm seeing some nods. So I'll include that this evening. And if you're going to be out or not able to make it, make sure that you you come up and ask me about the work in Albany. I'm really excited about that work. I want this morning to talk about two statements, one in Exodus 19 and one in Joshua 1, and this phrase, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." I stole the lesson idea from Andy Mitchell when I was at a camp. When I was at Soul Camp a little while ago, and there we go. And one of his lesson ideas that he was presenting was taking near identical or even absolutely identical phrases spoken by different people in the Bible and considering the attitudes behind it. And I thought that was fascinating. Even the phrase, "I have sinned," and you look up all the times that someone said, "I have sinned," and you look at the person and you think, you don't mean what you're saying. Or you look at the person and you say, you do mean what you're saying. One phrase that he referenced that I thought was really powerful was, "All 12 of the apostles said, 'Lord, is it I?' when he says, 'One of you is going to betray me.'" And I know that 11 people were honest in that question, "Lord, is it I?" And there was one guy who knew what was going on. I think that that's just really interesting to consider. And I want to look at, in Exodus 19, the phrase isn't going to be completely copied in the book of Joshua, but in Exodus 19, in verse 9 is the key phrase, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." And I want to look at what was going on and that led into the statement itself. And let's think about their attitude and who these people were, the Israelites at Mount Sinai. Both is going to be about the Israelites. It's Israelites in Exodus and it's Israelites in Joshua. So I'm going to call them Sinai Israelites and Canaan Israelites, the ones who are about to go into Canaan. In Exodus 19, verse 1, "On the third new moon, after the people of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that day they came into the wilderness of Sinai, and they sent out from Rephidim and came to the wilderness of Sinai, and they encamped in the wilderness. There Israel encamped before the mountain while Moses went up to God. The Lord called him out of the mountain, saying, 'Thus shall you say to the house of Jacob and tell the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel.' So Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words that the Lord had commanded him. And the people answered and said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." Moses reported the words of the people to the Lord, and the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I am coming to you in a thick cloud, and the people may hear, that the people may hear when I speak with you, and may also believe you forever." And so God reveals his saving power. He says, "You know what I did to the Egyptians? You know how I carried you on eagle's wings, and I brought you to me? And if indeed you will obey, you will be amazing people. You will be awesome people. You will be my people, a royal priesthood." And the people answered, "Very well, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do." And as you continue, really through this account, God comes down on the mountain and he starts giving them laws. They had been receiving some laws. They already knew about how to do the Passover, and they already knew, don't touch this mountain. So they were used to getting laws from God. But when these Ten Commandments come, and the manner in which they come, if you jump to chapter 20, verse 18... "Now, when all the people saw the thunder and the flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled, and they stood far off and said to Moses, 'You speak to us and we will listen. Do not let God speak to us lest we die.' Moses said to the people, 'Do not fear, for God has come to test you, that the fear of him may be before you, that you may not sin.' The people stood far off while Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was." They had this great opportunity to see God. They see the thunder. They feel the thunder. They see the flashes of lightning. They see this mountain shaking and smoking, and there's this trumpet blowing, and they don't want to listen to God. They're okay with hearing what he has to say, but they don't want to hear him say it because it is more than they are really willing to take. So this is a big event for them. And there's this test of fear that God gives them, and they pass the test with flying colors. They are terrified. And then Moses says there in verse 20, "This is that the fear of him may be before you, that you may not sin." This is good. Keep this with you. Don't fear, but keep this fear with you. I love Moses' statement there. It's a little bit tricky, maybe. But you need to have this with you so that you will not sin. And then you start flipping pages through your Bible, and you get laws, and you get laws, and you get laws, and then finally you get to chapter 32, and it's astonishing. They've turned aside to a different God. In Exodus chapter 32, when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, "Up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." So Aaron said, "Take off the rings of gold that are in the ears of your wives and your sons and your daughters and bring them to me." So all the people took off the rings of gold that was in their ears and brought them to Aaron. He received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord." And he uses that big word for the Lord. Your translation probably has an all caps L-O-R-D there. Maybe some of your translations even include Yahweh or Jehovah. He's using the big name for God here. "This is it," he says, "and we're going to have a feast to Yahweh with this cow." And they rose up early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And then we have that great classic phrase, "and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play." And it's only great because it's so realistic. Because you can just imagine, what were they doing? And it just didn't take long, did it? They saw God's power, his power to punish the Egyptians and to save them. So they saw his power. They saw that he liked them, that he cared for them, that he was willing to carry them out. They understood the conditions of what it means to obey and what it means to disobey. It wasn't complicated for them. They clearly understood what was going on. And so they made the commitment. "We are going to do it. We will obey." They vow this. And they so quickly turn away. It reminds me of Galatians 1:6. Paul says, "I'm astonished that you were so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ." And they were so quickly turning away from God who lifted them up and saved them and reached out to care for them and to make them special. And they are willing to abandon what they saw and abandon the fear that they felt. I think that that's significant. It really gives me pause to consider how important seeing is believing really is, or how important how I feel about something is. Because they sure felt it, and they sure saw it, but it sure made no difference to them. And there was something else going on. Matthew 13, with the parable of the sower, I presented this lesson last week, and one of my comments was, I don't know the percentage of lessons that does not include the parable of the sower. I almost always go to Matthew 13. My Bible has that permanent open crease to this passage here, because it's just so useful. It very clearly and easily describes so many of the problems I find myself in, or the fears or concerns I find myself in. In Matthew 13, verse 5, other seeds fell on rocky ground where they didn't have much depth of soil, and immediately they sprang up since they had no depth of soil, but when the sun rose, they were scorched, and since they had no root, they withered away. And when Jesus describes that in verse 20, as for what was sown on rocky ground, this is the one who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy, yet he has no root in himself, but endures for a while. And when tribulations or persecution arises on account of the word, immediately he falls away. This is that shallow soil, and it seems like the shallow soil seems to have this supercharge effect on the seed, that it immediately springs up, maybe even because it's shallow, but since it has no depth, and since it has these rocks, there are these things that are blocking the chance for there to be roots. These opportunities to lay down roots of trust in God, roots of love of God, they want to send down these roots, but there's this old rocky baggage of that old man, possibly. And the roots don't go down, or they can't go down, and the sun comes up the next day. And that shouldn't be a surprise to the plant. God made plants to have gigantic leaves to get as much sunshine as they possibly can. So the plant shouldn't be surprised that noon happens every day. And the plant is okay with the heavy heat of the sun because the plant has roots. The very nature of the leaves is to absorb the sun, and when the heat is too intense, they draw upon their deep roots for strength, for support, for sustenance. But if I don't lay down those roots of working to trust God, working to have faith in God, if I don't work at having that, I have this empty, shallow, no depth, unprepared life. So lies, confusions, they're going to disrupt me. I'll be afraid of something. Something is going to tempt me. Maybe a new temptation I haven't experienced before, and it surprises me. I start to get impatient, or I can just presume to behave in the way I want to, which is what we talked about with Cain some this morning. Just the chaos or the agitation in life, different disruptions in what I think is a normal life, and this just burns my soul because I don't have the roots down and ready. And it's sad. I think this is why they failed. The people, they saw God, they felt God, they feared God. In a lot of ways, they had a connection with God that I can't have here on earth. We have a different connection with God through His Son. But they had an experience that I haven't had. And sometimes there's that feeling, well, if I could have just seen God, or if I could have just looked at Jesus, or actually heard Jesus preach, chances are I'd be falling asleep in his sermons too. Because this personal or physical interaction didn't seem to make the difference. Because they didn't put down these roots. And that's really what I think it all gets to. If we don't set these roots down, it doesn't matter if, like we talked about in our Bible class this morning, if God shows up and says, hey buddy, if you do well, will you not be lifted up? And if I have no roots, I'm just going to ignore God. In Numbers chapter 14, this is after they had wandered through. Maybe they just had that problem in Exodus 32 because it was really fresh. Now, in my experience, when I'm really fresh and excited about God, that's when I usually don't have problems. But maybe that was their problem. They were new to this experience. And after they wandered through the wilderness for a while and they finally get to Canaan, they say, man, I wish we were dead. I wish we were dead in Egypt. I wish we were dead in the wilderness. So it's not, even as they had the chance to grow, it's clear that they continued to refuse or fail to put these roots down. Remember how they had that fear? But it wasn't a really good fear. In John 4:18, there's an interesting statement about how there is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. For fear is to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not been perfected in love. And so John is telling us that we really, fear is great. It might be a great beginning point, but we need to grow to more than mere fear. And the next verse says, we love because he first loved us. And so these Israelites who are wandering around in the wilderness, yes, God saved them, but they didn't seem to meditate and think about that. And in their pride, they thought, well, we also ran away really quickly. You know, God saved us, but you should have seen me run. Or, I know that God bought me and brought me out, but I am pretty amazing. So it makes sense that that's what God would want to do when he saw me. And I know that God was scary that day, but that was a few weeks ago, and this looks really tasty. And that's really what it is. They didn't sit and think about the obvious things. So when you get right down to it, I think laying roots doesn't have to be a difficult process. It merely means we have to stop and slow down. We talk about that idea a lot. They had no dependence on God for their life. They just had demands for God, for more food or different food. They had no love for God. They didn't have a love of God. They did have the boss is coming down the hall, so get busy really quick, fear of God, though. And those things didn't do any good for them. Where we do see success with the Israelites is when they're going into Canaan. I don't have a good picture of them getting a talk from Joshua, so I have a picture of them. This is actually... this wasn't taken the day Jericho fell down, but it's pretty close. If you turn to Joshua chapter 1, we see it's the Israelites still, but it's not the same crowd. And so these are the ones I'm calling the Canaan Israelites, and I'm probably going to call them Christians because I keep jumping to that image. The Sinai Christians and the Canaan Christians, and that's not at all who they are, but I keep making those jumps in my mind when I'm thinking about this. There's a lot of success here. The carryover phrase, we saw it in Exodus 19 in verse 9, and here we see it in Joshua 1 verse 16, all that you have commanded us we will do, and wherever you go, send us, we will go. It's not exactly word for word. They said all that the Lord has said, and here they're saying to Joshua, all that you have said. But when you look at what has been going on before Joshua, and before they have a chance to respond to Joshua, you know that God is talking. In 1 through 9, God comes to Joshua and says, be strong and courageous, and be strong and very courageous. And be strong and courageous. He repeats himself over and over again because Joshua needed to hear it. And in verse 11, Joshua is speaking to everybody. Pass through the midst of the camp and command the people, prepare your provisions, for within 3 days you're to pass over this Jordan and take possession of the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess. And then he says in verse 14, remember that there was the 2.5 tribes that they were going to stay on the one side of the Jordan. And the command was that you still have to fight with your brothers. And he says in verse 14, your wives, your little ones, and your livestock shall remain in the land that Moses gave you beyond the Jordan. But all the men of valor among you shall pass over armed before your brothers and shall help them. So leave the women and children at home and y'all cross with your brothers. And I don't know if it's the entire camp that's responding in verse 16 or just those 2.5 tribes. It makes no difference to me. They make this commitment, all that you've commanded us, we will do, and wherever you send us, we will go, even though I have to leave my wife and my kids and my livelihood at home, unprotected. I mean, other than God. But that, they understood that. And so when they make this commitment, they know what they're doing, and they make a promise that sounds a whole lot lot what we saw in Exodus. But when you jump to the end of Joshua's life in the book of Judges, in Judges chapter 2, verses 6 through 10, when Joshua dismissed the people of Israel went each to his inheritance to take possession of the land. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great work that the Lord had done for Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110 years. And they buried him within the boundaries of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of the mountain of Gaash. And all that generation also were gathered to their fathers. And there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work he had done for Israel. And what's tragic is how sad that last statement is, because sometimes it makes me forget of how amazing the whole paragraph is. How many times in the Bible do you ever get the statement, and that generation did a good job when so-and-so was alive, and everyone who outlived him? That's amazing. Here is a generation, and those who lived longer than Joshua kept that leadership of Joshua, or really the leadership of God, throughout their lives too. That's astounding. This is a group of people who do it. All that you've commanded us, we will do. And they did it, and they did it, and they did it for years and years and years. Verse 7 has that key idea, all who had seen the great work that the Lord had done for Israel. Oh, that must be the big difference. They had seen what God did, whereas those people who were terrified on Mount Sinai and had been brought through the Red Sea, and oh no, they saw God too. So why did they succeed? I don't think they saw anything extra, necessarily. They did see their parents dying in the wilderness. They understood what those years in the wilderness was teaching. They weren't hungry for leeks anymore, because they understood where that hunger took them. That whole desire to sit down and eat and drink and to rise up and play, they understood where that sort of lifestyle took them. They saw, but the reality is that Canaan Israel saw the same thing as Sinai Israel. They felt the same things. They had the same opportunities for fear. So I think the big difference is what they were bringing to the table. We have that phrase. What do you have to offer? Or what are you bringing to the table? And what are you willing to do or to sacrifice or to give up? What are you willing to pay? What are you willing to go through because you have been setting these roots down? How hot of a sun are you going to be able to withstand? It's going to get pretty hot today. Are you going to be able to deal with it? And so how does a person translate the data of reading a text in the Bible or, in their case, experiencing the fire of the Lord? That's just data. How do we turn that into root building? The way that we beat selfishness, I think, is that we meditate on God's provision. God really has provided. And I need to have a job, and I need to take care of myself, and I need to take care of my family. But God is the one who's provided. I'm not the provider. How do we beat pride? I need to think about God's law and His righteousness and realize my decisions get me into trouble. God's law brings me toward righteousness. There might be some difficulties along the way, but we start meditating on the truthfulness of God's words and the power of God's words, and that's how we get, we root out this pride. I think they allowed the consequences of sin to sink in. They saw what it meant to pursue that, and they understood what it meant. They worked to learn the lesson of learning from God's teaching, His power. We could say that, well, they lived 40 years in the wilderness, so they grew up the hard way. Their parents were slaves. Who had it harder? Their parents were slaves that God physically took out of slavery. We use that as our understanding of salvation today. So their parents had just as much opportunity to learn. I think that maybe they weren't reliving the glory days. That's what I think of when I read Philippians chapter 3. I love this passage because it's so scary. It's so ugly. I want to start with Paul's good attitude in verse 12 and close this section by looking at the ugly attitude that Paul is warning us to stay away from. Paul says, starting in Philippians 3:12, "Not that I have already obtained this or am already perfect, but I press on to make it my own because Christ Jesus has made me His own." Brothers, I don't consider that I have made it my own. But one thing I do, forgetting what lies behind and straining forward to what lies ahead, I press on toward the goal for the prize of an upward call of God in Christ Jesus. Let those of us who are mature think this way. And if in anything you think otherwise, God will reveal that also to you. Only let us hold true to what we have attained. Brothers, join in imitating me and keep your eyes on those who walk according to the example you have in us. For many, of whom I have often told you and now tell you even with tears, many walk as enemies of the cross of Christ. Their end is destruction. Their God is their belly. And they glory in their shame with minds set on earthly things. But our citizenship is in heaven. And from it we await a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform our lowly body to be like his glorious body, by the power that enables him even to subject all things to himself. Therefore, my brothers, whom I love and long for, my joy and crown, stand firm thus in the Lord, my beloved. Think about all the activities that Paul talks about, which have in their heart this idea of root building. I don't act like I already have it. I don't act like I already have perfected it, but I keep working on it. I forget what's behind, and I lean forward to what's ahead. I keep my eyes on those who are walking the right way. Those are all root-building behaviors. Paul says, I don't think I have it, y'all. I'm still working at it. And that's what we need to take into ourselves. And he warns us in verse 18, because there are people who walk as enemies, and they worship their gut. And their end is destruction. And they glory in those glory days. That idea of, now, don't ever do this because it's a sin, but let me tell you this really cool story about what I did when I was a sinner. That's not the attitude we're supposed to have. We should be ashamed of those stories and either never tell those stories to get them away, or if someone needs to be warned of the dangers of sin, tell that person that story. But there's no glory in that. There's nothing good in that. I think these new Israelites took on responsibility and took on conviction. They didn't look back to Egypt. They looked forward to the promised land. That's what it talks about in Hebrews 11, 15 and 16, about looking forward to that city that God had ready. This is the, what sort of practical day-to-day thing do we do? Well, I don't vacuum under the couch every day. I don't vacuum every day. I suspect to get this photograph, somebody moved the couch to a clean section of the room in order to get this photograph. David says, create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. David is active in begging God for that help. Don't spend all day cleaning the same spot on the floor. The dust is in the corner of the room. The dust is underneath the couch with the toys and the dog food and the other things. So when you clean the floor, the spot underneath the couch is still really gross. And, you know, allergies are kicking into gear. I'm getting that itchiness in my throat. My eyes are watering. It's because you've got mold and dust. And now I'm scaring all you homeowners. You have all these problems. You haven't cleaned the filters on your air conditioning unit and the dehumidifier. And if you're sick, then that's what needs to be cleaned out. You don't clean the table again. So these are the things that we need to do. We need to root out the problems of pride. I don't have to stop because what I'm doing is okay. It isn't that bad. You know, I can handle this sin, which is an interesting phrase. This is actually a good thing because, and they start filling in a blank, and I wasn't even asking a question why you want to do that. Why are you defending something in that way? I don't really agree with the way the Bible has that phrase. And that idea, and the selfishness of, I just don't want to stop. Oh, I can't stop. Or I can stop whenever I want to. I deserve this. These are the lies that the Israelites killed themselves with in the wilderness. In Matthew 23:25, Jesus doesn't talk about a vacuum and a couch. He talks about the cup and the dish. It's the same idea. We have a display of nice china teacups, and we bought this little shelving unit, and it holds them all nice, and they're way up high. Maybe they're at eye level for you, but they're way up high for me, and they're really nice. And if you ever want to drink tea or coffee out of the nice cups, you have got to get, you know, the deep scouring, scrubbing tools, because they've been sitting up there, and they are so pretty, and they have just been collecting everything that we've been breathing out for the past however many years. This is gross. But they look pretty on the wall. I promise you, I will clean it if you come over. But when they just sit up there and they look nice and as a decoration, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. But if we are going to assume that that's good enough for my life, that is good enough for me, then I need to realize that I am ripe for a tumble. It is about to happen. Let's look at 1 Corinthians chapter 10. This is really what it's all about. How are we going to use these stories? The Sinai Israelites, oh yeah, God, we'll do it all. And they just didn't. And the Canaan Israelites, we will do it all. And they did. How can I be like those ones that were talking to Joshua? 1 Corinthians 10:1. For I want you to know, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and they were all baptized by Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. These were saved people who were not pleasing to God and weren't saved. Isn't that terrifying? If it's not, what's wrong with you? We need to wake up and understand that saved people who don't please God, they're not really saved. Maybe God helped me get out of that mess that I got myself into, but now that I'm getting myself into a new one, where am I? And so these, when Paul's talking to the Corinthians, he's saying, you have to understand that even with all these spiritual gifts that these Israelites, almost called them Christians, even though the Israelites had all these spiritual gifts from God, they didn't stay saved because they were selfish and they were proud. So he wants us to learn from it. He says to consider, starting in verse 6, now these things took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did. Don't be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. And this is horrible stuff. Bowing down to a metal cow because they were tired of waiting for Moses and God. And what am I bowing down to? Because I have this selfish presumption and I know that my thoughts are good enough. That's what Paul is warning us from. My wanton hunger. I love the word wanton. It's so ancient, but it really conveys that idea, doesn't it? I just want this and I am going to do it. And that's what sexual immorality is. That self-indulgent, because I am important attitude. And testing God, doubting what he says, distrusting what he says, like when the serpent said to Eve, did he really say that you couldn't eat anything? That's that attitude. Unbelieving of God, or maybe having these expectations and demands of God that God had no intention of getting into. And then you have this, why isn't God there for me or doing what I want to do? And then you start grumbling and being frustrated and exasperated. And you have these childish tantrums because I got myself into a mess and why isn't God fixing it? And that's what these Israelites did, and that is what Paul is warning us about today. Don't act this way. Make a commitment to God and send roots down that will bust those things out of the way. And so he continues in 11, 12, and 13. These are verses that we all know very well. These things happened to them as an example, but they are written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come. Therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you that isn't common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with the temptation he will also provide the way of escape, that you may be able to endure it. And so, nothing... We need to learn from their bad examples, and learn from the good examples also, but understand that their failures are very clear, and you know, some of the failures in the Old Testament are so over the top. Well, I'd never go that far. But that's not the point. If you're going any distance, the over-the-top story is pointing out just how bad you are. And so we need to learn from that. And then so he says, if you think you're doing well, be careful, because they sure thought they were doing well. This is a lesson for the person who knows they are doing well. This is a lesson for the person who, I am fine, but you're not a Christian. But I think even more so, this is the lesson for the Christian who's fine. Because it's, Paul was writing to Christians. People who haven't made a commitment to God, you need to learn this lesson because it's important. But Paul was writing to Christians when he said this. And he said, you've been sitting on those pews long enough, you need to wake up and think about this. And think about what you are doing. If you think that I have my struggles under control, no one struggles with drowning. You just drown. You might struggle with swimming. You might not be a good swimmer. But when you're drowning, you're drowning. So don't say you're struggling with sin. Say, I'm stopping sin. And get out of that mess. And then verse 13, I think verse 13 is a fabulous statement. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. Every statement in this whole verse is either going to be encouraging or discouraging to you. Man, I thought I had a really special big problem, sin. And that's why I couldn't quit it, and that's why I wasn't going to quit it. And Paul says, nope, you ain't special. And God is faithful and will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. Oh, that's good to know, because I'm sure that tomorrow's going to be a hard day. Or on the other side, oh, that's really frustrating, because I really thought I had to sin yesterday. We need to take this and be encouraged by it, learn the lesson, and realize that God is going to help me, even at the times that I'm not really, maybe not prepared to help myself. That God is there, and He wants to help me. We need to root out this selfishness and this pride. We need to take personal responsibility. We need to not look backwards and instead look forwards. Think about whatever these classic Bible phrases, whether they're literally in the Bible or maybe a motivational idea about taking off the old man and putting on the new. When you're baptized into Christ, we have clothed ourselves in Christ. Whatever those phrases are that encourage you, make those a part of your daily habit. And that's how you set these roots down, so that you won't, in 40 days, start bowing down to a metal cow, which is silly. We don't have to do that. God is ready to help us to stay away from that. We'll close by looking at Psalm 24. I do not know who is a Christian and who is not a Christian here. Back home in Albany, we rarely do an invitation because we know who needs inviting and why wait to the end of a word. I mean, there's just so few of us. Everyone who's there is a Christian, and when we have non-Christians, we know what they need and we're talking like that. I don't know what you need. And I do know that you all need God. And the point of this lesson is, don't think that you're just fine and you've got a good, I had a 20-ounce drink of God on Sunday and I can make it through the rest of the week. It's a daily, it's a constant, and you need to grow in that. So I encourage you to reach out and talk to your sisters and brothers or those who are here willing to be your sisters and brothers and to respond to that. And I know that we often have the tradition of coming forward when we sing. After this song, this is a great time to ask for help. And I know that there are people here who love you and want to help you. Think about what it is that this psalm is saying about what we can be to God. But really, so much of this psalm is about how big and great God is. And let that motivate you to trust in Him and love Him. Psalm 24 and the lesson will be yours. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, The world and those who dwell therein, for he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord? And who shall stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who doesn't lift up his soul to what is false and does not swear deceitfully. He will receive a blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. Such is the generation of those who seek him and seek the face of the God of Jacob. Lift up your hands, O gates, and be lifted up, O ancient doors, the King of glory, that the King of glory may come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord, strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O gates, and lift them up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Who is the King of glory? The Lord of hosts, he is the King of glory. May God bless our efforts to trust and love him so that we will not wither in the sun. Thank you.